Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Newspaper obituaries often include references such as lost a battle with Alzheimer's or died after a lengthy struggle against cancer. But are we sabotaged by cancer? Can battalions of white blood cells outflank carcinoma? Military metaphors for medical conditions are common. Doctors themselves promise to help patients fight illness, but not every patient wants to think of him or herself as a soldier. That's the topic of a new article in The Atlantic, written by our guest, medical resident at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, Dr. Dhruv Kular. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Where does the idea first appear in medical history, as far as we know, when it comes to referring to illness in terms of with military metaphor?
I think that military and battle metaphors in medicine have probably been around as long as there's been the idea of medicine and the concept of disease. It's a very natural way, I think, of thinking about the two. But the first widespread modern instances, I think, come from around the 17th century. John Donne, in the Devotions, he talks about the miserable condition of man, and he describes illness as a siege, a rebellion, a heat that blows up the heart like a mine. And he goes on to say things like, disease is a cannon that batters all, overthrows all, demolishes all, and destroys us in an instant. And so we see this from the patient perspective very early on. And then even from the physician's perspective, there's a very famous doctor named Thomas Sydenham, and he's known as kind of the English Hippocrates, and he was around the 17th century. And he, in one of his essays, he writes that there's a murderous array of disease that has to be fought against, and the battle is not a battle for the sluggard. And so he talks about his aim is to investigate illness and comprehend its character and then proceed straight ahead in full confidence towards its annihilation. So we really see this for the past couple centuries at least. And these metaphors have been with us so long now, I think we internalize them and we don't even really recognize how they influence on a day-to-day basis. Even today, we monitor for insidious disease and we destroy rogue cells and we use all weapons at our disposal. And so it's really a part of the fabric of how we talk about these things.
You started off your article referring to your own experience with a patient that you had left with, you've got a great team caring for you. We'll fight this together. And just the way you wrote it, she looked pensively out the window as the sun began to rise. Yes, she finally said, I'm a fighter. And that's what triggered this question in your mind about whether that was appropriate.
Right.
Why is
that? I think the main problem is that by describing treatment as a battle and patient as a combatant, we set this adversarial tone. And that's not really what I would like to think of medicine being. We start thinking of medication regimens that we change as setbacks, retreats, and the end of a battle as kind of the end of treatment course as a battle lost. And so we place this very unfair burden, I think, on a doctor and a patient, when in reality, it's often not in either one's control. And you can be the most courageous soldier, and you can have the best kind of general as a doctor. And even with all that, you end up losing, quote unquote, this battle. And I think that's a really unfair way of looking at it, because often people who have the best of efforts and the most positive attitudes, they also pass on, right? And so do they lose? Do they not fight hard enough? That's, I think, a very poor way of framing the whole topic. And I think for some people, the battle metaphor might work, right? So some people might be inspired and have these elements of resiliency and determination when they hear about military or battle. But I think most people probably wouldn't identify with that. And a better way might be thinking of it maybe as a journey or a marathon or a roller coaster with ups and downs.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like life.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
My guest is Dr. Dhruv Kular. He wrote an article for The Atlantic recently about the issue of using military or battle-style metaphors in treating disease and illness. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So beyond how somebody feels emotionally about it, What does the literature say about using military metaphors in medical treatment? Is it necessarily bad? Are we just talking about feelings now, or is there more to it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think first of all, it's a very important. We were just talking about how some people think of this language as just semantics, but I think that's really not true. I think the words that we choose to describe illness are very powerful, and they create the environment in which we design treatment plans and we choose different treatment options. And it really affects the way people view their own diseases, the way they cope with their diseases, the way they view themselves. And so it's very difficult to quantify and study issues around meaning and metaphor and language. And a lot of these arguments do come from anecdote, but the people that have tried to study it do offer some evidence that the military framework isn't the best one. And so there's this famous Polish physician named Bish Lepowski, and in the 1970s, he pioneered this framework for thinking about how patients ascribe meaning to their illness. And he interviewed many cancer patients around their time of diagnosis, and he asked them to ascribe a certain type of meaning to their illness, whether that was a challenge that they had to go through or a valuable experience that they were going through to get better in some way, or something more negative, like the illness was an enemy or a loss or a punishment. And what he found was that that several years after, those patients who viewed their disease as an enemy, those patients tended to have higher levels of depression, higher levels of anxiety, and poor overall quality of life than those who ascribed in more positive meaning. And they also had higher pain scores, lower coping scores. And these findings have really been replicated in a number of other conditions, including rheumatoid arthritis and some other autoimmune conditions. And so there is kind of a basis, a literature around this topic that supports the anecdotes that a lot of physicians and doctors see themselves, and that it's not a good thing to be thinking of illness as a battle or an enemy, really.
Yeah, that something's out to get you.
Right, exactly. Mm.
Paul in Dublin, you're on the air with Dr. Dhruv Kular. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say, thank you very much for this topic. I've thought about the same thing myself many times. Mm-hmm. I don't like the use of militaristic terms
right.
Just in general. My daughter's undergoing cancer treatment right now, and I've mm-hmm. been involved in a lot of civic action type campaigns. Yeah, that's the way I think of it. You do have an adversary, but it's not
right.
Not violent.
Right.
I don't
right.
like to think of it that way.
Yeah, I think most people would probably have the same kind of identification as you do. Are there other ways that have been helpful for you or your daughter?
Yeah. Well, I personally think about it in terms of a campaign. It's mm-hmm. something that you've got to work on. You got to have a plan. You got to do stuff, but the whole idea of setbacks, they happen, and you got to find a way to overcome them, or it's just avoiding the violence,
right.
which I think is all too pervasive in a lot of aspects of our culture, and to put it in the context of medicine just seems wrong.
Hmm. Right, right.
Paul, thanks a lot for your call, and best wishes for your daughter's recovery.
Thank you very much.
It's interesting to hear what Paul has to say. I didn't ask the age of his daughter. I had a sense that she was older, but do we know about differences between children and adults in terms of the semantics?
Right. So most of my work and most of what I've done has been with adults. But I can see the fighting metaphor being actually attractive for some youth, and they are perhaps more likely to identify with the ethos of good and bad and fighting and winning and losing. And it, I think, could help inspire some resiliency and determination and optimism in these patients. But I also think there's a much potentially bigger downside, because they're also more likely to see it as a loss or a personal failing, I think, if things don't go well. And I think this idea of I didn't try hard enough may resonate particularly strongly with them if they have less life perspective or life experience than adults do. So I think we should be even more cautious with children than adults with these types of metaphors and language.
Let's talk about other ways to conceptualize disease. And Paul mentioned calling it a campaign, and I knew what he meant, not a military campaign, but something, a project that we have to work on.
Right.
What other, I guess it could be almost as, depends on the individual. To what extent should a physician think about the individual as they craft their message?
Right. In medicine generally over the last few decades, there's really been this push to shared decision-making and preserving patient autonomy in terms of the decisions that they want to make with regard to their disease or with their treatment. And I think that extends 100% to the way that they want to view their illness. I think the main responsibility of a physician here is not to try to push one metaphor or another on, or even take away a metaphor if it really is the military metaphor that that patient wants. Mm-hmm. I think the main responsibility of a physician and other clinicians is to create an environment in which patients feel comfortable expressing themselves in any way that they want to, and allowing, regardless of what metaphor they choose, if that's the metaphor that helps them see their illness in a way that they can cope with, in a way that they can continue to stay optimistic about and have hope about, I think the main responsibility of the physician is to draw that out and not to project anything upon the patient.
I was going to say, because unless you've had a lot of bouts with serious illness, for a lot of people, it's a first-time experience. And
right.
You have to be in a state of shock, and you're really taking a lot of cues from your physician.
Right, right. And one of the interesting things we also found was that we found that patients who are encouraged to fight or encouraged to battle their disease, they often have higher levels of emotional distress and suppression. And they try to maintain this positive attitude to avoid upsetting family members. They try to avoid upsetting even their doctors and clinicians, which is really kind of, in my mind, the reverse of the way it should be. And so when we try to project or tell patients how to feel or how to act or keep a brave face, it often has a suppressive effect on the way that they express their emotions. So I've really tried to steer clear of that, although it can be difficult at times.
Joel in Grove City, you're on the air with Dr. Dhruv Kular. Hi, Joel.
Hi.
Thanks for your call.
Hi, Joel.
Hi, doctor. I'd like to say what you're saying. I'm a 24-year cancer survivor, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And after the initial shock, which is kind of also a war term, not shock and awe that it could happen to me. I was 43 when I was diagnosed. Something kind of kicked in after the fear. I had surgery. I went on chemotherapy. But I also used adjunctive therapies like Reiki and macrobiotic diet and massage. And I chose not to be a victim, a casualty. In a sense, tried to make peace with the natural process that was occurring in my body. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, most people know that most cancers are a disease of the immune system. And I did everything I could to strengthen my immune system, and it really helped me a lot. And to use the opposite of a war term, it was making peace with the process that had, in a sense, run amok in my body, proliferation of cancer cells. And I took up the white flag, you know, instead of trying to treat it as that it was me against the disease. And it helped me a lot. And I think it contributed a lot to my survival.
Joel, thanks for your call.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you.
You know, Dhruv, I want to ask you one more question before I let you go. What impact has this prevalent lexicon, medical lexicon, what impact has it had on, or how has it affected our relationship with end of life? Because I've had lots of conversations with folks about hospice and about palliative care now and how that's changing, that you know, sometimes people there, when you talk about giving up or, you know, seeing it differently than as in a battle, sometimes people are afraid of looking weak. And
right.
that issue has come up in palliative care and in end-of-life conversations and that sort of thing, that it's not giving up. They're just living or dying with it. I don't know.
Absolutely. I think exactly what you're saying. I think this is where the way that we talk about disease is almost most important, because at the end of life, people often try, or they want to continue to, quote unquote, soldier on. They want to continue to be brave and strong. And they often try kind of experimental treatment or things that are very unlikely to succeed, but very likely to give them significant side effects. And so instead of focusing on quality of life near the end of life, we often start to focus on quantity of life and just getting a few more days, whether or not those days are really valuable time that you can spend with your family. And so I think by thinking of these chronic diseases or these long-term diseases as more of a journey, or something like the last caller mentioned, coming to peace with them, we can really focus on how do we get the most out of our last few days rather than trying to extend them. And often these treatments, they don't offer quality or quantity of life. And so I think you're exactly right.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Dhruv Kular, medical resident at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, and also the author of an article in The Atlantic from a few days ago, The Trouble with Medicine's Metaphors. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Besides the label with your name and dosage, one person's 10 milligrams of Ativan is the same as another's. Pills are the same. Patients are not. And adverse drug reactions due to that conflict cost the nation about $3 billion a year. Enter the world of pharmacogenetics. And on the phone from Dublin, Ohio, to tell us about the technology's promise is the Chief Financial Officer of ViaQuest Healthcare, Kathy Richard. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning, Ann.
What is pharmacogenetics?
Well, pharmacogenetics is the study of how our genes affect our response to drugs. Every human has a genetic code that is unique to them alone, and there is no perfect version of the code. Each patient has variances in that genetic code. These genetic variances play a critical role in medication, as genes are responsible for the metabolism, the transport, and the safety and effectiveness of each medication. So variances in these genes that play a role in medications can be of no consequence to a drug's safety or effectiveness, render a medication useless, or result in a medication causing a serious adverse reaction. The genes that are responsible for the safety and effectiveness can be evaluated through pharmacogenetics, resulting in the recommendation to avoid certain medications, dose adjustments to make the medication safe and effective for that individual person, or no drug or dose change recommended at that time.
What are the risks of imprecise dosing?
The risk of imprecise dosing really variances on all patients. Genetics is estimated to account for 20 to 95% of the variability in all drug effects. So adverse drug reactions found that 16 out of 27 adverse drug reactions, which you quoted, the cost to our healthcare system, were metabolized by a gene with a known polymorphism or a variant in that gene.
So ViaQuest Home Health and Hospice is putting this into practice. What role does it play in what you do? How does it work?
ViaQuest, we developed the pharmacogenetic program. We first rolled it out into our hospice. We are actually the only home health and hospice provider nationwide providing pharmacogenetics at this time. We rolled it out into our hospice under pain management. So each of our hospice patients that consent to the testing go through the pharmacogenetic testing for that pain management. In hospice, there's a lot of guesswork. Most of our patients, hospice is all about dignity and comfort of care and quality of life. Most of our pain management protocols are identical unless there is something specific related to that disease. So what we do on admission is we do the pharmacogenetic testing, which is a non-invasive cheek swab testing for the pain management medications that we would prescribe to that specific patient. What we have found in our program in the first 3 months is that from our standard pain management protocol, based on the genetic testing, we have found within our agency a 29% variance in the patients that we have tested, meaning that we have changed the dosage or the type of medication that that patient would have received without that genetic testing.
What kind of genetic testing would suggest a changed dosage of, say, morphine?
How it works is you are given one gene from your father, one gene from your mother. If you receive two good genes for the enzyme specific to that pain management, you would be what would be called an effective metabolizer, which means that we would expect that the medication for morphine on that enzyme would deliver the therapeutic effect that we would suspect. If you have a variance in those genes and you receive one bad copy or two bad copies, you may have to avoid morphine altogether, meaning that you could deliver the morphine, take the morphine, it would cause an adverse reaction, or you would receive no therapeutic benefit from that morphine.
Couldn't you just, if someone's not actually allergic to something, just try it and have say, it's not working, it's not killing the pain, or it's giving me hives, let's switch to another medication?
That is our current practice right now. So what happens with that, if you look at hospice, for example, end of life, 4 days in pain for you or I is really not that big of a deal. When you only have less than 6 months and you're looking at quality of life, that 4 to 6 days of unnecessary pain is a large percentage of what hospice is all about. Not only that, what happens with pain medication is when we deliver pain medication and it is not effective, we tend to increase the dose of pain medication, which also causes safety risk of falls, decreases a patient's alertness as well. So with the pharmacogenetic testing, we know that we're prescribing the right medication in the right dosage that will be effective for that patient's pain.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Kathy Richards. She's the Chief Clinical Officer of ViaQuest Healthcare. And we're talking about the practice of pharmacogenetics, which they're using in their operation there. It's headquartered in Dublin, Ohio. And they work with home health and hospice settings. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you're headquartered in Dublin. What triggered the use of this process in the first place?
Well, ViaQuest is all about finding innovative ways to increase the quality of care in the most cost-effective way. And where healthcare is leaning towards all the cost reimbursement, the amount of medication expense within hospice as well as home health, the amount of readmissions to hospitalization for medication management brought us to the point that we needed to develop some type of program. Pharmacogenetics was that program we decided to create.
And when you talk about, you said it's just a swab and that sort of a thing, what kind of reaction have you received from your clients?
Our clients, our satisfaction rate for the pharmacogenetic program has been at 100%. We have increased our satisfaction rate with the family members in hospice as well as our referral source and our physician.
Does that mean that everybody's participating in it?
Currently, right now in hospice, we have had 100% participation. Now, we also have pain management in home health, as well as we have a pharmacogenetic for behavioral health. That is based on clinical algorithms and medical necessity because we would not want to test 100% of all patients.
Okay. So why would that be?
Well, in hospice, pain is inevitable, so 100% of hospice patients will experience some type of pain management. In home health, for the behavioral health and pain management, we only test those that are currently not responding therapeutically to their current treatment.
Okay, and I suppose this would be more relative to the home health scenario, but obviously there's a big problem in the United States with addiction to pain medications. How might pharmacogenetics help in that case?
Pharmacogenetics would be able to eliminate or at least determine whether or not the medication a patient is taking is effective. So what happens, you know, without the testing and the funding currently right now to test for narcotic abuse is a in the future will be part of that pharmacogenetics, because truly we can't determine, it's a subjective, pain is subjectively, whether or not a patient truly is receiving pain management from the medication that they're being prescribed. So is the possibility there that a patient is increasing narcotic usage because they have a genetic variance? Yes, that is very possible.
What kind of test does the FDA do now regarding dosages before a drug is approved? Body weight and gender can make a difference, I know, but how do they figure it now?
Well, how they figure it with pharmacogenetics, if you go to currently right now, there's 122 commonly prescribed medication in which the FDA has listed on their prescribing drug labeling that they recommend pharmacogenetic testing. However, it is not mandated at this time.
And as far as the genetics that are the genes that are looked at, are they the same ones that say are responsible for metabolizing food as drugs, or what specific genes or kinds of genes are they looking at?
They're looking at currently right now, there are six main enzymes on a gene that is responsible for approximately 90% of all medication that is prescribed today as far as metabolizing and distributing that medication. Those six enzymes are specific to that medical management.
Okay, so what I mean, is there a location in the body those enzymes operate, or is it digestive? Is it?
It's actually based on your DNA and your RNA.
Okay.
So it is located on one specific enzyme. It's called P450, and that enzyme actually has 50 different enzymes attached to it. And within those 50, six of those enzymes are responsible for the genetic variances in prescribing medications for 90%.
Huh. All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Kathy Richard. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Kathy Richards, Chief Clinical Officer of ViaQuest Healthcare in Dublin, Ohio. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's been said that women don't sweat, we glow. Tell that to my boot camp teacher. But whatever you call it, Americans spend billions of dollars every year trying to keep their armpits fresh and dry. In fact, a lot of us probably wish there was a pill to stop the whole smelly process altogether. The only problem is a cure could prove deadly. Joining us now by phone to tell us why sweat is our friend and a host of other wellness news is chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back, Dr. Swartzberg.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So I might be one of those weird people, but when I'm exercising and so forth, it doesn't bother me that I sweat. It kind of feels good, but why do we sweat?
Well, we sweat to keep alive, essentially.
That must be why I like it so much.
As our body's warm, the only way we can cool ourselves, or the main way we can cool ourselves, is by bringing blood to the surface. And as the blood gets to the surface of our skin, it cools by convection. But that's not sufficient. So we also sweat. That is, we pour fluid onto our skin. And then as it evaporates, it's just like an air conditioner, the evaporation cools our body.
So the blood coming closer to the skin, is that why our faces get red and that kind of thing?
Exactly. That's called convection, and that helps cool us, but it's not sufficient. So we sweat to keep us cool.
Now, physical exertion causes us to sweat. A lot of times some exercise regimens, they don't want you to drink a lot of water during the exercise.
Well, I don't think in general that's good advice. I think where that may be coming from is people who are doing, for example, marathons. If they drink an awful lot of water without replacing what are called electrolytes like sodium and potassium, it can lead to a severe drop in the blood sodium level, and that can be dangerous. But frankly, that's really way out there at the extreme. For you and me who go to the gym or jog or whatever, I think it's important to remain hydrated.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. All right, so we also sweat in emotional situations. Stress can cause sweat. Why is that?
Well, it's because of a release of some hormones in our body under emotional stress. And that stimulates the sweat glands to pour out some fluid. Also, for example, there's some foods like if I eat something really spicy with pepper in it, mm-hmm. the top of my head gets all wet. So there are receptors in our mouths that can be triggered by a variety of spices and other foods that will also stimulate sweating. So there are other things besides a rise in body temperature.
The rise in body temperature and the reaction of sweat makes sense. Why, in what way does perspiration benefit us when we're under stress? It seems like it makes it worse for me when I am.
Well, that's probably a little less clear. Some people have argued, and this is purely hypothetical, that those same hormones that when we're under emotional stress or something fearful, those same hormones cause sweating perhaps because it's preemptively cooling our body down because we may have to run. What I'm getting at is if you see the saber-toothed tiger behind you, you're going to know you're going to need to run very quickly. So you may need to start to cool your body early. But again, that's very hypothetical.
And what about the relationship with menopause? It's just that you're body temperature's out of whack all the time, and
well, it's
what's
again,
going on
hormones.
There? Tell us. Well, that's the hormone thing again.
It's different hormones than the ones we were just talking about, but it's the hormone thing again, and it causes the change in those hormones cause changes in the blood vessels and changes in the way those sweat glands are stimulated.
Sweat's a pretty big deal, then.
Sweat's a pretty big deal. If it wasn't for sweat, we couldn't have survived. You know, a lot of animals, for example, our dog, they can't sweat at all, except dogs, for example, right on their nose can sweat a teeny amount. And without being able to sweat, there's only a certain amount of running an animal can do before it has to stop because it has to cool off. And as we evolved as human beings, we could chase, even though we couldn't run as fast as many animals, we could run longer than those animals because we could sweat in our entire bodies.
What makes sweat smell bad?
Well, it's not the same sweat as we see from exercise. There are two types of sweat glands. The ones we've been talking about, called the eccrine sweat glands, are all over our body, including our palms and our soles, everywhere. And that's just water and electrolytes. That doesn't smell bad. But there are other types of sweat glands, primarily under our arms, in our groin area, that also produce proteins and fatty acids. And those come out, and then the bacteria on our skin use those proteins and fatty acids to survive. They feed on them. And it's those bacteria that produce the smell. So the sweating that we have from exercise really doesn't smell, but it's from the other glands, the apocrine glands they're called, that cause the odor. And it's not really the protein and fat that's coming out of them, but again, it's the bacteria feeding on them and then the metabolic products of the bacteria that we smell.
Is it dangerous to sweat too much, even if you're exercising?
Probably not. There are some rare medical conditions where it can be a problem, and if you sweat too much with exercise and don't replace those fluids, then it can become very dangerous. But as long as we're replacing them, it's not a danger.
And it's not a marathon-like situation where you're losing the electrolytes.
Right. Again, though, it's terribly important that as we exercise, we keep up on fluids because mm-hmm. when we're sweating, and it doesn't communicate to our brains that we're thirsty yet until we've lost a considerable amount of water. So our minds don't know we're thirsty until we're down on fluids. So you really shouldn't wait until you're thirsty to replace those fluids.
And then as far as how we treat our sweating, any verdict on the safety of antiperspirants with aluminum and that sort of thing?
Yeah, there is a verdict on that, and the verdict is that they're safe. Okay. There were concerns expressed primarily in the non-medical field about aluminum and breast cancer in terms of aluminum in antiperspirants, and that's really been debunked. So there doesn't appear to be any danger with that.
Okay, moving on to our summer quiz.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to ask talk about everything in your summer quiz in the newsletter, but or wellness letter, I should say. But keeping with the summer theme, although it's been a wonderful summer here in the 70s and 80s almost every day, but you published a quiz about summer in the last wellness letter. Let's talk about some of the more surprising findings, starting with foods and beverages that cool us off. Cold water seems obvious, but hot tea and chili peppers do too. And does that relate to what we were talking about earlier?
The chili peppers and the ginger, for example, that does relate to what we were talking about earlier, that there are these receptors, nerve receptors in our mouths that are stimulated in many of us with, for example, chili peppers that cause us to sweat. So that's what we were talking about. But I actually was a little surprised, too, with the hot tea. And apparently what happens is that if you're hot or if you're warm and you drink hot tea, it warms our body even more and causes us to sweat more, and the sweating will actually cool us down more than it would have if we didn't drink the hot tea. You know, it's a really interesting paper that we reviewed and we're commenting on with this, but the marginal effect of that increased sweating if you're hot is probably very small. So I don't think I'd necessarily suggest that if you're real hot that you should drink hot tea, but it is interesting that it will cause you to sweat and then it will cool your body more quickly.
Any sense about the benefits of room temperature water versus, you know, the great nice cold bottle of water?
No.
Doesn't make
not
a difference.
Really.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's whatever appeals to you at the time.
Poison ivy and poison oak, common summer hazards in this part of the country. A lot of people think it spreads when you scratch it. Is that true?
No, it's not true. The cause of poison oak or poison ivy rash is the chemical in those plants called erosinol. And that chemical will lead to an immune reaction in our skin, and maybe a few days or even a week or so afterwards that the rash comes out, long after that chemical is gone from our skin. So you can't spread it. Once the rash comes out, you're not going to spread it by touching it and scratching other areas. And you won't spread it to somebody else at that point either.
It's not contagious.
It's not contagious, but the oil on those plants is highly contagious. So, for example, if your dog, who won't react to that oil, has the oil on his or her coat, as long as that oil's there and you pet the dog, then you can get a reaction to it. Or if you're using some tools cutting down poison oak or poison ivy and you get the oil on those tools and then you touch those tools even a week or a few weeks later sometimes, if that oil's still there, you'll get the reaction. But you can't spread it to somebody else.
Not by shaking hands or anything like that?
No, not unless you've got the oil on your hand at the time.
Well, I've been stupid enough to do that, I'm sorry to say. But
but, you know, when you have it on your hand, once the oil's on your hand, you don't know it because it's going to take a while, several days, to get the reaction. So you're not going to know you can spread it.
Well, one of the problems is if you do get it on your hand, then you could spread it all over your body.
Well, that's for sure.
If
and that's how we
there.
Spread it over our bodies.
Right.
But because we don't know it.
But it's not by the scratching. And just one more thing. I've heard that if you burn poison ivy or poison oak, and you're in the fumes of the fire, it can be a problem. Do you know anything about that?
I do. It can aerosolize that oil, and then it's possible to inhale it. And in large doses, if you inhale it, you can get that reaction in your airways. And that can be dangerous. It's also very rare.
Okay. Grilling. Another summer quiz topic, one of the season's pleasures, although I like to do it year-round and even in the dead of winter. But should we worry about the carcinogens that are formed from grilling?
I think worry is perhaps too strong, but we should have some concern about it and try to guard against it. We know that cooking meat and other foods at very high heat over a barbecue can produce a couple of different chemicals, or groups of chemicals. Heterocyclic amines are classically the ones, and there's some others. And these have been shown to be carcinogenic. So I think even though it's not a major cause of cancer, to the best of our knowledge, it seems prudent to try to avoid these heterocyclic amines.
Does it matter if it's charcoal or gas?
The gas tends to not cook quite as high, and you can control it a little better, but otherwise it doesn't matter very much.
Because it's what you're cooking.
Exactly. And there are some tricks you can do to decrease that. For example, when I barbecue chicken, I'll cook it first in the oven until it's pretty well cooked, and then I'll just put it on the barbecue and not so hot that it burns for a very short period of time. Or sometimes I'll use indirect heat on the barbecue, so the heat's around it but not right underneath it. A really good trick is, if you like to marinate your food, is to marinate it in anything that doesn't have sugar in it. Sugar will actually accelerate this process of producing these heterocyclic amines. So, but other marinades will actually decrease the reaction on the meat. So marinating meat, for example, even there was a really interesting study we commented on with black beer for 4 hours before grilling, dramatically reduced the amount of heterocyclic amines produced. Unfortunately, I don't really like black beer as much. Pilsners didn't work quite as well, but they worked.
You know, it made me think about, when I read that, about the evolution of cooking and how rubs and marinades came into being. And it probably, I mean, it made sense to me that it's part of our, you know, really a pretty common and very, very old cooking technique, maybe because it used to save our lives.
Maybe. I don't know.
Preserved the meat better. It did a lot of things, but it made me wonder about that too, because those certainly aren't new techniques of cooking.
Well, I think it's an interesting point. I don't really know.
Now, moving off of summer quiz topics, because summer's almost over with. Next time I talk to you, we'll probably be doing back-to-school type of stress-related issues. Who knows? But pap test. Some changes might be coming to the pap test familiar to all women. We already know that the recommended timing or scheduling of pap test has changed. So what is the COBUS HPV test, and why is that part of the regimen now, or might become part of the regimen?
Yeah. Well, the test is a very interesting and very good test. It tests for the strains of the human papillomavirus that we know are the cause of cervical cancer. And so it can, in a very sensitive way, detect the presence of that virus on the cervix. And if you don't have that virus on the cervix, your chances of getting cervical cancer are minuscule. So to that extent, this test is an advance.
So did the traditional pap test also screen for that? Have I ever been screened for it? Do I know?
Well, you may not know. The test has been around for a little while. And if you're over 30, there's a good chance your doctor may have done both the pap and the HPV test. The test is done the same way the PAP is, in terms of taking what's called a speculum, and then identifying the cervix, and then just rubbing the cervix with a little stick, and then that's what's analyzed both for the PAP test as well as for the HPV test. So you might not even know. But, you know, I don't want your listeners to think that the PAP test isn't a good test. In the United States, it's a fabulous test. It really, if people are screened on a regular basis for the presence of abnormalities on the PAP test, you're going to really prevent any serious problems with cervical cancer. So, and this is where the controversy with the HPV test comes in. If the PAP test is really good, then do we really need in the United States the HPV test? And that's where the debate is.
Well, what's the answer to that? I mean...
Well, the answer is that we're going to probably find out over time. We need more studies on this. Some people are concerned about the HPV test because it's so sensitive that it's going to identify people that have HPV on their cervix, but the vast, vast majority of those people will never get cancer. So it may be too sensitive, and we may be creating fear in people that don't need it and additional procedures in people that don't need it. Now, there is one part of the, there is one caveat to what I'm saying. The Pap test depends upon technologists who are really well screened and can do this test and read those cells. In the developing world, there are not a lot of technologists who are trained to do this. And that, I think, is where the HPV test can make an enormous difference, because that's completely automated. You don't need a highly trained technologist to diagnose what's going on with a Pap test.
In that regard, is it cheaper?
No, the HPV test is more expensive, and that's another problem with it. Right now, it's about twice as much money.
Why is that?
I don't know. New? Maybe it's because it's new.
They have to make their, you know, they have to make their money off it. And what do you mean by a regular basis?
Well, that's changed. Right now, it's every 3 years is sufficient for a Pap test, unless you're at very high risk. For example, have immunodeficiency problems or previous problems with your cervix, et cetera, and your doctor can advise you about that. But for the otherwise healthy person, it's every 3 years, and you can stop after the age of 65 unless you're at high risk.
Bonus, but you know, a lot of people in my age group grew up with the once a year thing. It's still offered. What do you say to people? Should this is something they should have a discussion with their gynecologist?
Absolutely. Yeah. The recommendations for every 3 years are based upon really good studies that is absolutely sufficient. And the reason for that is that once you're infected with HPV, if you're going to develop cancer, which is unlikely, but if you're going to develop cancer, it usually takes several decades. So doing it every 3 years is plenty often to pick up any changes very early to resolve the problem.
Did the Pap test become such a routine part of healthcare because it was easy to do and relatively inexpensive? Why? There's so many things we test for, and it sounds like not that many people get cervical cancer?
Well, that's not true.
Okay.
The cervical cancer prior to the Pap test was one of the leading cancer causes of death in women.
Okay.
So it was very common. The reason why you don't think it's very common is because anybody who gets regular Paps, mm-hmm. like we've been discussing, is not going to die from cervical cancer. The people who die from cervical cancer in the United States today are people who don't get regular Pap smears. So it's very easy to prevent this disease.
I suppose it's kind of exciting to find out, you know, in coming years what the impact of the healthcare, the Affordable Care Act will have on that.
I think it's going to help. I really do. It'll give access to medical care for people that previously couldn't have it. But, you know, before we finish this topic,
sure.
I want to just say one last thing, and that is the HPV vaccine can prevent cervical cancer. So if you really don't want to get cervical cancer, make sure all women should get it, and so should all boys.
All women of any age?
All women up to the age of 26.
Okay. And yeah. and boys as well, which is not often something very well known.
Absolutely. Yeah, boys aren't going to get cervical cancer, but there are other cancers associated with HPV in males. Not very common. But most importantly, if a boy doesn't get HPV, it means he can't spread it to a girl.
Right. It's the transmission function
exactly.
of it. Right.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. John Swartzberg, he's chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.